intended to be starting this a couple minutes earlier, but I've got my iPad with all my notes and everything, and I sat it down just next to me, just here on this day bed sitting here on the balcony, and I went to start the video and I picked it up and it goes, oh, it's too hot. Like, literally have to wait for the iPad to cool down before you can do anything with it. So I'm inside with the iPad, like putting the iPad in the fridge on the beer, trying to cool it down so that I can actually start this video. So how hot is it? Watch says 39 Celsius at the moment. So this is absolutely one of the hottest parts of the country here. So I'm next to Uluru, previously known as Ayers Rock, now referred to by its indigenous name, which is pretty obvious where I am actually, because a big bloody rock behind my shoulder. And it is just amazingly cool here. Now, obviously, this is live streaming as well. Just for those of you who may watch it later on, I can see the comments. Yo, Darren, I'm conscious that I am doing this on what is New Year's morning for a lot of people. So here in the Northern Territory, where I am at the moment, it's 4:45 in the afternoon, which is what makes a beer o'clock again. I know particularly for people in Europe, it's first thing in the morning, New Year's Day. So far, 2021 has been fine. I just want to get that out there. Nothing at all has happened. Not here anyway. Yeah, you'll work that out when you get up. So anyway, a little bit on sponsor first, and then I do have a bunch of InfoSec things, which is why I needed to cool my iPad down, because I want to talk about some of the notes and things I made. And then, like I did last week, I'm just going to tell you what I've been doing on this holiday. And if those of you who are interested in a little bit of Aussie trivia or, you know, what the outback is like, stick around, ask questions. I can obviously see the comments there at the moment as well. And we'll see. Some of you people might find it a little bit interesting. But anyway, on the cyber stuff, first up, as always, sponsors. So 1Password is up there in the sponsor bar again this week. So big thanks to those folks. I don't think anyone here needs an introduction as to who 1Password is or what they do. It's awesome stuff. You should be using a password manager. You should be using 1Password. Go and get yourself a version of that. That's a good 2021 resolution. And in fact, it will be like bang on 10 years right now, because I remember it was 2011. Right during the Christmas holidays, I think straight after New Year, that I went and first bought 1Password and started moving everything over. So if you want a good New Year's resolution or something to do on your holidays, and if it's not you, like, do it for your relatives or something like that. Get the family version and set your partner and your kids up and things like that. So that's a good way to start off the year. Alrighty, so a few things here. Quite a number of different data breaches, actually. So there's one here from NZ Geek. Now, so here's the information, nzbgeek.info. Now, it's kind of interesting, and just a bit of context, I wasn't exactly sure what nzbgeek did, but apparently, and their site's down as well, someone, don't quote me on this, this is hearsay from the internet, but someone did make a comment about it being on the edgier side, I think, of piracy. Now, regardless of what they do, it is relevant. And I'm just trying to see what the comment was. Oh, here we go. Someone says, surprised to see you linking to what is essentially a piracy site. Still glad you did. The breach could be pretty serious, and it's important people are informed. Now, look, whether it's piracy or something else completely different, it's a breach. If your data's in there, it is relevant and it's newsworthy. People can find piracy sites very easily if they want to find piracy sites. And incidentally, this one is obviously offline at the moment anyway. So here's what's interesting on this site. Their disclosure says, hey, geek, it is with a heavy heart that we must admit that we've had a security breach. Anyway, the interesting bit here is it goes through and it says, the hackers were able to place a keylogger on the website. The hackers obtained a copy of our database, which includes your username, encrypted password, and a little bit of a liberal use of that term there, email address, and last connected IP address. It kind of makes me wonder, if they've got a keylogger on the website, why would they be getting a copy of the encrypted, which probably means hashed, database? Because would it not just be grabbing the password client-side in the DOM on entry, Magecart style? So that was a little bit odd. During this time, we had the hard drive and our indexer file along with an API server. PayPal data is not at risk, providing you do not use the same username password for NZBGeek. I'm sure absolutely nobody does that. So That's those folks advised actions. If you use the same username, password combination, or any other website, please change them. You should use 2FA, two-factor authentication with all your online accounts. Fair advice there. I'll give them that one. Looking at the comments over here, why 1Pass and not Bitwarden? I have written many, many times before, one of the biggest things that attracted me to 1Password, initially, if you go back to the original blog post from 10 years ago, which was the only secure password is the one you can't remember. So I looked at a bunch of different password managers then. 1Password had the best support for all the different devices I used. It integrated everything neatly. It synced across them, which was really important for me. So I started using that at the time. And then over the years, well before I joined their advisory board and this sort of thing as well, I got to know the folks there more. I spent a bunch of time with them. And honestly, for me, a big part of what kept me with 1Password and then attracted me to I guess, have a more formal role with them is I really, really trust the people there. Now, that's not to say there are not good people in other password management companies. Now, having said that, I can think of some password management companies where I haven't had good discussions with people. Won't name them. But honestly, a lot of it now is trust in the leadership, trust in the technical people there, and just always consistently finding them really, really good folks. In fact, the last thing I'll leave you on that, because I also don't want to, am I in a position now I can't get into like a slanging match with different password managers? Possibly. The last thing on that, and I've said this publicly many times before, with many of the other password managers I'd spoken to over the years, conversations with them would normally be a conversation with like a marketing manager or someone pitching or selling or something like that. And every time I had a conversation with the folks at 1Password, it would always be someone right at the top of the tree who was just deeply technical and passionate about the crypto they use and the security and the privacy and this sort of thing. So they're on our wavelength. Let's put it that way. All right. What else? There's a comment in here as well from Abby here about being open source and self-hosted. Look, I mean, if open source is important to you, well, you're going to need to find a non-proprietary solution. If self-hosted is important to you, same thing again. I think the thing that's, I'm trying not to go down the rabbit hole here on like literally my first bullet point. The thing that always gets me with the open source argument is the position that people believe if it's open source, everyone will look at it and will know it's okay. Now, that doesn't always happen. OpenSSL is a perfect example of that. And it also sort of misses a large part of the value proposition of what a company like 1Password does in terms of really extensive audits, pen tests, bug bounties. They've got a very, very substantial bug bounty as well for anyone that can do things like take over someone else's keychain. So there's huge investment gone into the security of that product. I don't think that just having the code open source sort of replicates, what's the right way to put it? I don't think that the assertion that just because it is open source means everything is going to be okay is a good one. If it's more a philosophical thing, we don't want to play for software, fine, go and use like OpenOffice and all the rest of it as well. And then the self-hosted bit, I got enough shit to host. I don't want to host like a password manager as well. Everything with 1Password is encrypted client-side. They never see anything in the clear on their end. I want to just be able to add a new device like this iPad, for example, and connect to my account and do so in a fashion that's strongly authenticated and ensures that it is actually me that's connecting to my things and then sync it across all devices. So there's a massive, massive, massive usability upside. All right, moving on. Darren says, don't try climbing that rock or the Dreamtime voodoo ghosts will strike you down. Either that or giant smurfs with guns might kidnap you and throw you in a cage. I feel like Darren's still been drinking from last night. Maybe on the second bit. The first bit is one of the things that's changed a lot in Australia over recent decades. And if I think back to when I can remember as a kid, say in the 80s era, there was a lot around giving Indigenous folks back land and giving them back rights. Because let's face it, like white Australia was settled by British people coming invading the place, as they did in many other parts of the world. So thank you, British people. That's it might have been cool then, not so cool now. So the last few decades has been a lot of handing things back to the Indigenous folks. And Uluru, and even moving from the name Ayers Rock to Uluru, has sort of been part of that. And one of the things you used to be able to do on Ayers Rock, and it was just sort of the other side of the right there, because we drove around there the other day and had a look, you used to be able to walk up to the top. So they had rails and I think they had just sort of had like posts in the rock and then a chain that would go up there and you could walk up to the top. And I think it was only, I was going to say last year, but I think it was only 2019, which is the year before last, I got it yesterday, where they stopped doing that. So you can no longer climb the rock. And then even back as far as the 80s, they took away the campgrounds that anyone could go and stay in just to the left of the rock and built out another sort of dedicated, I guess, resort sort of setup, including this spot and a few other places over there, and handed the original campgrounds back to the Indigenous owners. So everything has sort of changed much more in that direction over the years. But yeah, you don't go climbing the rock. There's in fact, there's a little cultural centre on the other side, which we had a look at yesterday, and there's lots of stuff in there, like the you know, the sand and the rocks and everything is sacred. Like, don't take a rock away, don't take the sand away. I'll talk about the sand later on, actually. It's kind of interesting. And there's all these quotes from people sort of from different parts around the world who took sand away 30 years ago and are now sending it back in a vial because they've realized that it's of cultural significance. So anyway, that's how the sentiments, I guess, have changed over the years. Okay, what else is on here? I'm just going to move on to the other things on my list here before I come back and do a lot more of the things around me in terms of the Aussie tourism stuff. So what else we got here? Aussies targeted by COVID scam. So this is as sure as night follows day. The headline here is thousands of Australians targeted by coronavirus scammers pretending to be government officials. Now, frankly, coronavirus in this respect is just the same as any other catastrophic event in the world, whether it's like plane crashes or natural disasters. When something like this happens, it's almost like a rallying cry for scammers. Yeah, people are desperate for more information. They're fearful. They're more subject to social engineering techniques, which sort of, it could be anything from one of the ones I've seen very early on COVID-wise was one which is like, here's an attachment with a list of all your co-workers who have got COVID. Wouldn't it be interesting to have a look at that? And of course, nosy people go and open the attachment, run the macros, whatever else it may be. So the headline here is our ACCC, the Australian Consumer Competition, who are they? Protection Watchdog. A warning, some scammers are pretending to be contact tracers. More than 5,000 Australians were targeted in COVID-19 related scams this year, as scammers take advantage of people's fears during the coronavirus pandemic. And that's particularly nasty, because imagine a contact tracer, someone claiming to be a contact tracer, contacts you. How would you word that? You know, like if you wanted to word that in terms of, you might have been to a location of which there's been an outbreak, you would be shitting yourself, right? Like you'd be very, very concerned about having COVID. You would open that attachment or click that link, certainly much more likely to do so than if it was your typical, I'm a Nigerian prince kind of thing. So particularly nasty stuff there. More than 5,000 coronavirus-related scams were reported to monitoring service ScamWatch this year, costing Australians $6.28 million. Now, Australia is but one very, very slice of the world, so you would have to imagine that you're looking at much more in the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of fraud already committed with COVID as the lure, if you like. So pretty nasty stuff there. All right, so there's that one. Cafe Press. Now, this one just popped up, and I thought this was interesting for a couple of reasons. So Cafe Press had a data breach. It is in Have I Been Pwned? And the headline here is Cafe Press to pay $2 million settlement for 2019 data breach. Now, I'm always a little bit in two minds about financial settlements from a data breach, or as a result of a data breach. And the minds, with it, before I delve into the detail of this, is simply this. Organizations that have shortcomings in their security posture that ultimately lead to the detriment of other people need some sort of financial penalty. There needs to be a little bit of a stick there somewhere. So that needs to happen. But the other part of the mind here, and this is what kind of upsets me a little bit more, is that when we get to things like class actions, and I've had so many times where class action lawyers have contacted me and they've said, hey, let's just say it's Acme Corp. You know, the Acme Corp data breach, you've got it in Have I Been Pwned? People had email addresses and passwords in there. We're mounting a class action. Well, all right, well, what for? Oh, people have been hurt by this. maybe, how do you prove that? And keep your eye on the data breach. Like I'm sort of fully conscious of the fact that data breaches do have an impact on people. But what's really, really hard is when there's so many different data breaches around, and then there's so much password reuse and all these other things, which people themselves are sort of doing the wrong thing on and making the whole damn thing worse. How do you have an incident like the Acme Core data breach and go, yes, that incident has caused people harm? It's a little bit different when it is something that has a very large amount of personal information. There's much fewer of those data breaches. And if it's very, very specific information, if it's card information, you can trace it to fraud, different sort of story. But just the sort of data that was in here, I just feel a little bit uncomfortable about it, namely because it feels very much like ambulance chasing. And most of the time when I've had discussions with class action lawyers that have reached out, it's gotten to the point where I'm like, look, this doesn't feel cool. You know, there needs to be regulatory penalties, absolutely, and we've got better constructs now than we ever had. Probably still not sufficient, but they're moving in the right direction. But I feel very uncomfortable with the premise of lawyers just getting people together just to try and make money out of a data breach. And that's what a lot of this feels like. Now, not saying it's necessarily the case with Cafe Press, but the deal here, remember Cafe Press did things like customized t-shirts, mugs, and wall clocks. People still have wall clocks. Calendars, so on and so forth. Feb 2019, 23 million email addresses, physical addresses, contact numbers, passwords, credit card details. I don't think it was full card details either. If only there was a way to find out, such as via Have I Been Pwned, which will tell me exactly what was in there. And if I look at who's been pwned, here we go to Cafe. Da, 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 Cafe Mom. It was not Cafe Mom, different Cafe, Cafe Press. So what do we have in here? Exposed data include 23 million unique email addresses, some records also containing name, physical address, phone numbers, and passwords stored as SHA-1 hashes. All right, they do deserve a bit of a kick up the ass for that, but at the time, I didn't note card details, but maybe they were in there. So apparently, as the company completely failed to protect information of its customers, completely as opposed to incompletely, the Attorney General, William Tong, announced that the online retailer will pay $2 million as settlement, okay? Out of which 750 were divided among the states, of which those living in Kentucky is said to receive $64,000. You would have to think that when you have a $750,000 pot and you got 23 million people in there, now granted the 23 million is worldwide, this does seem to be a more US-centric story here. Still, like, how much money do you get? Like, do you get a couple of coffees out of it? Like, was this really worth the effort? I don't know. Anyway, so that's these folks. Looking at the comments, Andrew says, your tour across Australia looks awesome, really cool locations and backdrop. Yeah, and look, again, I will talk more about that at the end of this as I get through the cyber things. And I am on a clock today as well because I've got to go and do the last touristy thing I'm going to be doing this location. I'll talk about that a bit later. Indigo. So Indigo, as in I-N-D-I-G-O, which is apparently a Indian airline, which I was not aware of. So they've got a disclosure here. Someone just sent it to me today. This is possibly the last one of the year, December 31, it's dated. They've made a disclosure to their publicly listed company regulatory body because they have to report these sorts of things. They said, we would like to make this disclosure that some of our servers were subject to a hacking incident earlier this month. We were able to restore our systems in a very short span of time with minimal impact. There were some segments of data servers that were breached, so there is a possibility that some internal documents may get uploaded by the hacker on public websites and platforms. We realize the seriousness of the issue, and I continue to engage with all relevant experts and law enforcement to ensure that the incident is investigated in detail. Doesn't really feel very comprehensive, does it? You know, it's like one para with absolutely no details. But okay, that feels more like it is ticking the box of publicly listed, something happened that could be of a monetary impact. So, yep, disclosed, done that. Now, this one surprised me a bit more. A few people sent this to me, and it's a company I do have a relationship with, which is Redgate. Now, Redgate And that, just to be clear, the relationship is I'm on their Friends of Redgate program, so they give me free software, which, and I think from memory, anyone who's a Microsoft MVP can get it as well. But they make products that I've used for many, many, many years, primarily things like SQL Compare and SQL Data Compare and SQL Prompt. And they do a bunch of other stuff in the .NET space as well, but particularly going back, I reckon I've been using them for about 15 years. They, the tools have been really good at doing things like, I have two different databases. I want to compare the schema of them. And it runs and it says, here's this one and there's this one and this is what's different. Would you like to sync the changes from one to the other? So this is very often how I've ended up doing deployments at various stages. Now, so I've written a bunch of stuff about Redgate tools. And the disclosure, which they've sent to a bunch of people that do not include me. I haven't had a disclosure, which is interesting because they certainly do have my data. This one here, this guy's tweeted it publicly so I can say his name. Hello, Frank. I'm writing to you from Redgate security team. On 18th December, we were notified of a potential vulnerability in the configuration of a CRM system that could allow an attacker to retrieve certain records. We acted immediately to prevent this access. Achieving this on the same evening we were notified and have since been working with the two vendors involved to determine the cause and assess what records may have been retrieved. Now, I saw a couple of different people share this with me, so it does not appear to be a one-off. This came through at the time of writing, probably about 9 hours ago. So it looks like this is an initial disclosure. They got to dig a bit deeper and see if there's anything else actually impacted in here. So we'll keep an eye on that one. That is Redgate. Keep an eye on my inbox, see if I get one of those. And then there was just one other thing here before I get into the touristy stuff. Someone pointed me to this thread with a company called Long & McQuaid. Now, what do Long & McQuaid do? We are where the music begins. So they're based in Canada. And that the relevancy here is someone has found their email address in the Sit Zero Day collection of breaches, which I put in Have I Been Pwn? Gee, probably a couple of months ago now, 6 weeks ago. So this is the one that just had tens of thousands of different individual websites in them. And it was kind of a big thing insofar as there was a heap of stuff in there that I had not seen before that wasn't in Have I Been Pwn. And there are a heap of data breaches that even just with cursory investigation were actually legitimate. This sort of looked very much like it could have been fabricated, and I've seen a bunch of crap like this in the past. This one was fully legit. Let me rephrase that. Maybe it wasn't fully legit. There might have been some stuff in there that wasn't junk, but each time I tested things and checked whether accounts in an allegedly breached site actually exist on the site, it came up with a hit. And multiple different organizations, since I've put in Have I Been Pwn, I've published the big list of websites, have now gone and done breach disclosure. In fact, a bunch of them contacted me and said, look, we think this is legitimate. You know, can you help us figure out where the data is and verify it? And many of them did come back and go, yeah, this is real. So when this guy is reaching out, Peter Sobot, when Peter's reaching out to Long & McQuaid and saying, hey, look, I think you've been in a data breach, I think you've had a breach, that's something that you actually want to take seriously. Now, these guys have responded, Long & McQuaid, and said, our website was not hacked. Our IT team checks frequently to ensure that this doesn't happen. That's kind of like, how do you check and then establish that you have not had a data breach? It's like, first of all, what were the checks? Big important question there. And second of all, if you did not find evidence, does that mean it did not happen? And it's the old absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So that feels, even just the way they responded, doesn't give me a lot of confidence. So it would be interesting to see if that's legit or not. Now, Peter's point here and the reason why he believes that it is legitimate, I'm going to go back to his original tweet here. This is a tweet from the 19th November. He says, looks like Long McQuaid, Canada's big music store chain, may have had a security breach. Have I Been Pwn just alerted me that a unique email address I've only ever used on their online store was included in today's Sit Zero Day data breach. So that doesn't look great for them there. Incidentally, I had someone contact me and they didn't even name that the company. It was kind of vague. And I think there might've been a little bit of a culture gap too. Someone contacted me and was basically saying, can I take their website off the gist, which I linked to in the blog post about Sit Zero Day, because they've now dealt with the issue. And it's like, what? No, like this is an immutable historic fact. If your data was in there, you are on the list. It's not like you do whatever you do to deal with it, and then suddenly you just get to erase history. It doesn't work that way. And I did get a little bit impatient with them, if I'm honest, and then I didn't hear back from them again. But yeah, these incidents are immutable incidents. They have happened. You can't just kind of whitewash them away later on. All right, so moving on to the bump the camera there, but moving on to the Aussie stuff in terms of the trip, and I'll talk about the stuff here as well, but I guess going back chronologically, I did this a week and half a day ago in Port Douglas with my son Ari. We're talking then about where we'd been and what we've been doing, and I'm just going to pop open my tweet thread, because I do still have all of this going in one massive, big, epic tweet thread, which is covering all the different things we've done. And where are we now? That was the 25th of December back then. So we're in Port Douglas. Now, Port Douglas is Great Barrier Reef. It's far north Queensland. If you look at the map of Australia, it's on the very sort of northeastern corner. And that was sort of the last part of the holiday we did with the kids. So we were there on Christmas Day. We had a really fun Christmas Day, just basically mucking around like flying drones, shooting Nerf guns, doing that sort of stuff. I have put a photo of the family in there as well, if anyone is interested in seeing that, because I thought it was a very nice photo. And then the following day, we went to Cairns, up to the Sky Rail. Yeah, Sky Rail, they call it, which is basically a cable car that just goes up the mountain into the rainforest. And that was pretty cool. It goes up to a place on top of the mountain called Karanda, which is a little town in the rainforest. I remember going there with my mum and dad as a kid, probably when I was about Ari's age, about 11 years old. Felt like it had lost a bit of the magic. And in fact, I was speaking to my parents later on that day, and they'd been in more recent years as well, and said, oh, it got a little bit trashy compared to, I guess, the 80s when we were there. But we did that and then went for a nice swim when we got back down to the beach as well. 30 degrees Celsius in the water. And I think that must be the warmest water I've ever swum in. And they actually set out like a little, we normally have lifeguards on Aussie beaches anyway, but there was a lifeguard. And then they set out kind of pontoons, floaty stuff with nets hanging down to keep both the stingers and the crocodiles out. And we went there to swim in there and didn't get stung or eaten. So that was fun. Put the kids on a plane back home to the Gold Coast. That was the end of their holiday before Charlotte and I started the really long driving stuff. And then we basically just spent the next, 4 days, because it would have been 3 days driving across the country. So this was just under 3,000 kilometres to get from Port Douglas to where we are now in Uluru. 2,938 kilometres is what this image says. Now, a lot of people had asked about driving in Australia, and it's because it's such a big place, it really depends on where you are. To sort of talk about what that's like, and just going chronologically through the pictures, number one, it's a lot of bugs. So the front of my car is so smashed with bugs. And as a preemptive measure, before I even left, I've lined up a session with the detailer to try and get the AMG back into original condition, because there's so many bugs over this thing. And sometimes, particularly later on in the afternoons when it's getting towards dusk, you just be driving through like hordes and hordes of dragonflies and crickets and fairly large different bugs. Someone's playing a saxophone somewhere. It's a bit odd. Not quite you expect it. Like a didgeridoo. I would have gone with a didgeridoo. Anyway, so we're driving across the countryside. We had to stay in some fairly kind of ordinary places, just because there's really nothing between the coast of Australia and here. Now, this place here is absolutely freaking epically amazing, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But the two places we had to stay in between, much less so. In fact, the first one, I don't think I'd actually put a photo of this on there, but we kind of turned up there and it was like a very, very basic motel that was like part of a service station. You had to go in the service station and get a key, and then this like tiny little motel room, which was clean, but it's just there's so much nothing in the middle of Australia that a lot of the towns just have very, very basic facilities. Did that, spent a night in Mount Isa, which is basically just a mining town, huge amount of mining there. So Australia still has a big dependency on mining. A lot of our money comes from there. Then the bit which I guess was the most enjoyable driving-wise is going from Mount Isa to Alice Springs. It was actually 4 days we spent. So was it like driving in Australia? Well, as soon as we hit the Northern Territory border, so from Queensland, going that way, we're going west. As soon as we got from Queensland over to the Northern Territory, we go from 110 up to 130 k an hour, which is great because that extra 20 k an hour makes a hell of a long difference when you're driving for, in this case, I think about 9 hours that day. And it wasn't just that it's 130 k an hour. It's like the roads are straight. I've got an image in here which says go straight for 633 kilometers before turning left. So you're going straight for massive distances. It's flat. There are very, very few curves. And then a lot of cars aren't doing the 130 limit. They're doing 100 or 110, or they're towing a caravan and they're doing 80 or 90. So overtaking just a breeze. So it was literally like whack on the cruise control, podcast, sit back, relax, chill. And it was really, really nice driving. It was the most enjoyable driving I think I've done in a really long time. So in that one day from Mount Isa to Alice Springs, we did 1,169 kilometers in 9 hours and 28 minutes, which is an average of 124 kilometers an hour. Now, I had people reply to this and go, obviously, you're speeding. It's like, no. Well, let me rephrase. That's not what this means, because there are loads and loads and loads of 130 zones. So it was actually really, really good driving. Now, particularly if you're an Aussie and you're in the country at the moment and you really can't go to any other countries, I highly recommend doing that drive once. I would not want to drive back over it. I'm really glad I did it, but it does get monotonous. And particularly when, as I said before, all the accommodation options are pretty limited, I'd be happy not to do that again. So went to Alice Springs, which is sort of dead center in the country, saw some camels, that was cool, paid nearly $2 a litre for fuel, less cool. And then we got to this spot here. And I'll tell you a bit more about it, because obviously it's Uluru, Ayers Rock. There's also the Olgas, which is what I knew it as. I didn't realize that there is an indigenous name, which we use now, which is Katajuta, which is actually super cool. There's like 38 different massive rock domes. I think they're over about a 22 square kilometer area, up to, up to 300 something meters, taller than this rock, super tall. And because of all these domes, it makes like a valley through the middle of them as well. So we're kind of right in the middle of that. And the place where we're staying at here, it's called Longitude 131, and if you're interested, just go and have a look at it online, because it looks spectacular. And I had seen this in many brochures and things over the years, and this is the first time I've ever been here. But it's like you come in here, you got your own little, I guess they call it a glamping tent. There's like it almost looked like a circus tent, you know, big top over there. It's like a day bed here, there's a little fireplace to come and put a swag here. Swag for folks outside of Australia is like a little bed that you'd normally roll up and carry around the countryside as you're bush ranging or doing whatever. And then you sort of everything's prepaid for, and you come in here and it's just bars and pools and restaurants, and it's just absolutely amazing. And you'll see in the tweet thread that there's like a plunge pool at the top that looks out over Katajuta, previously known as the Olgas. And just like sitting there in this plunge pool in the 39 degree heat, looking out over this amazing scenery, getting beers from the fridge. It was just perfect. And there's a picture in the tweet thread. It's not a picture, it's a video. Literally looking bang out there at this camera angle now of the sunrise. So we got up about 5 o'clock morning after we got here, before the sun had come up, and the colors out there were just, it was sensational. It was absolutely amazing. So you can sort of see why the indigenous folks see this as a sacred area, because it is just very, very special. It's very, very different to anywhere else I've been in the world. Probably the closest places I can come to when I think about it is, we're in Death Valley last year in the US. Similar in terms of very bloody hot. It was 47 Celsius when we were in Death Valley last year. But then that's also below sea level. There's a lot of salt. There's not much life out here. There's actually a lot of life. There's a lot of greenery out there, which is super, super nice. There really wasn't much to do once you're in Death Valley, but here a combination of the indigenous culture and then, you know, obviously the rock and the Catajuda and all this is just amazing. The red sand is really interesting. So everyone's seen like the red sand of Aussie deserts before and pictures. I'd never seen it in person until this trip. And the red is because of the amount of iron in it. So even when you look at the rock, you know, it's super red. There's a lot of iron in there. It gets really, really hot. Like if you try and walk on that sand without shoes, you get about 10 seconds in. And then particularly when you get beneath the surface, because there's so much heat beneath it, it's crazy hot. And it's super fine sand too. It's much finer than what you'd probably find on most beaches. So that's just really, really amazing. And of course it's everywhere. And even looking around me here, there's like red sand over the deck, and I'm wearing a white top. So as soon as I sit down somewhere, I've got red sand on the back of me. So the red sand, everything is everywhere as well. The other thing that's everywhere is flies. Oh man, there are a lot of flies here. So they actually give you fly nets, which is, it's almost like a net you just put over your head, right? And then the flies are on the outside and your head's on the inside. And I haven't quite gotten to the point of wearing one of those yet. Charlotte did yesterday when we were out for a walk, but the flies are intense. Stars as well, because there's no light pollution. So we have had a full moon. What was it, a couple of days ago? I think a partial moon last night. Tonight should be epic because it should be a lot darker. So we're going to go out and do like an outdoor dinner where they serve you under the stars and then someone talks about the constellations and things, which would be pretty amazing. And, yeah, it's just that silence and brilliance of the stars is just out of this world. And talk more about this other stuff that's coming up. I'm just having a quick look at the comments in here to see if there's anything else that's relevant. So thanks for the Happy New Year's. As someone says here, was there much to see between Mount Isa and Uluru Alice Springs? Looks like you did the section in one hit, not stopping overnight anywhere. The one place that's between Mount Isa and Alice Springs is Tennant Creek. Now, just so I'm not disingenuous about the way I explain this, I'm going to pull up the Wikipedia page. Now, here's another thing I learned. Don't trust Google Maps. Now, the reason I know not to trust Google Maps is before we left, when we're back home on the Gold Coast, our very lovely next-door neighbours had just done a very, very similar trip, and they'd driven from Mount Isa to Alice Springs. And they said, you know, it's obviously a bloody long way, and I was showing them the map of where we're going to go, and they're looking at the map, which I've gotten bang off Google Maps. I've just literally gone, hey, Google Maps, let's go from Mount Isa to Alice Springs. And they're like, you can't go there, because it was almost like a straight line. They're like, you can't go there. You've got to go via Tennant Creek. And suddenly we added 300 kilometers to our trip in a day, and we'd already booked all the accommodation. So we had to be there at those times. And we're like, oh shit, that's not a great thing. Okay, well, I guess we'll just go through Tennant Creek. And our neighbor was explaining it. No, he wasn't explaining it delicately, but he was basically saying you really don't want to get out of the car at Tennant Creek. So there are lots of areas of the country once you're out in this sort of region, and I'm trying to sort of pick the right words without sounding obnoxious or disrespectful about it, but there are areas where there is a lot of poverty and there is a lot of crime. And the thing I was looking up on Wikipedia just now is when we looked up Tennant Creek, one of the things we noticed was over the past few years, a rising number of child rape, alcohol abuse, domestic violence, and family disputes between locals, despite such a small population, has been raised by numerous media sources and identified as a region of legitimate concern in comparison to other states and isolated townships. So, you know, not the kind of stuff you really want to be spending time around. And then you get into Tennant Creek, which again, sort of going back to the question here from Simon, is really the only place. Actually, no, there was another place. I'm gonna tell you what it is. It's really the only other place other than the one I just remembered where you can stay. But again, like it was a 9.5 hour drive, you know, tracking along at, let's say, very close to speed limit. And it was a good drive. And I was happy to sort of do that in one go. So we did stop at Tennant Creek because I had to get fuel. One of the things I was worried about is with most high-performance cars now, they need 98-octane fuel. Now, you can get 95-octane pretty much everywhere. We usually call it premium in Australia. 98-octane, you're much more limited. And, in fact, in Mount Isa, the Shell station was out of 98-octane. There was a Puma station but we were there when we were leaving. We were leaving on a public holiday because it was effectively the Boxing Day holiday carried over from the weekend, and that station was shut. And then the United station was shut. So there was a bit of fuel anxiety, to be honest. But we did manage to get some fuel the next morning before we headed off from Mount Isa. Tennant Creek fortunately did have 98. I do have a couple of cans of octane booster in the boot just in case it came to that. But yeah, that was that. Now the thing I'm looking up, in fact, I made sure I took a photo while I was there just in case I ever come back this way again and I can remember to stay there. But there was actually a nice place along the way. And I think we sort of realized later on our lovely neighbors had pointed out that this is a place they had stayed. Tablelands. Where on earth is this place? Barkly Highway. So on the Barkly Highway, which is massive, there is a place called Barkly Homestead. Now, Barkly Homestead, if I zoom sort of way out on this, is, I want to say maybe about the one-third mark between Mount Isa and Alice Springs. And it's in the middle of nowhere, but it's actually really green. So it's obviously watered a lot. It looked basic, but it looked actually quite nice. In fact, I probably would have preferred to stay there rather than Mount Isa. And in fact, when I did sort of looked at this, the previous day's trip from somewhere, I forget where, Richmond, I think, to Mount Isa was about 400K, and then it was 1100K. So I probably would have rather just keep going another few hundred K, stay in Barkly Homestead. So yeah, in answer to your question, Barkly Homestead would have been the pictures there. All right, so looking at the other comments here. So Darren says, did you drive at night, see any kangaroos at night? So the answer is almost no in terms of driving at night. So we're normally pretty early people anyway. We'd normally get up at 5 a.m. or something. So we've just been getting up early and driving and then not needing to drive at night. Coming into Richmond, we did come in probably about right at the end of dusk, let's say, just before it got dark. And that's where we got a lot of the bugs and stuff on the car. A lot of people have said you've got to be really careful between here and Cooper Pedy, which is where we're going to next, because there's a lot of kangaroos, camels, stock. So, yeah, literally cows, just no fences. They just wander across the highway. And, in fact, whilst we were driving down here from Alice, we stopped at a service station and a couple pulled up in a car and the whole front corner of the car was missing. And I was looking at it going, shit, what did you hit? And the woman's like, kangaroo. So, far out. Okay, well, make a note not to do that. But they were obviously tourists, and they said something like, oh, we saw lots of kangaroos and we were looking at them, and then we didn't see the one that jumped across in front of the car. So we'll definitely not be doing that. But not driving at night is one way of avoiding that. In fact, the last kangaroo I saw, other than very, very occasional roadkill, I see a lot more kangaroos on the side of the road when I drive down to the snow back in back in around Threadbow area than what I have here. Last kangaroo I saw, I don't even know if I've seen any wild ones. It was in the wildlife park in Port Douglas. So anyway, just leaning over to scroll through some of these other comments here. Andrew, Troy, hope you reach out to Australian Tourist Board. They need to have something like this on the Visit Australia site. You should tell their CG is an Australian. Look, I appreciate everyone sort of saying that it's been good watching the journey and seeing a bit of Australia. And for everyone's reference, like this is stuff I have never seen before. I have never been to this state. I've never been to South Australia, which we'll go to tomorrow. I've never seen all this stuff. So this is new to me. A couple of hours ago, I posted a tweet with some TripIt stats, which showed last year I traveled 243 days. In fact, what did I actually say here? Because this is sort of relevant to the discussion just here. So my stats for last year were 281,000 kilometres, 243 days of travel, 54 cities, 13 countries. This year, 54,500 kilometres. Now, that included me flying back to Oslo. No, what did I do? What did I do at the start of the year? I flew from Oslo back to Australia, and then I got my son and I flew from Australia back to Oslo, and then snowboarding London back to here. So it includes all of that stuff, which all finished in start of Feb. But yeah, 34 days this year, which includes this trip and the bit in Jan. I only visited 12 cities and 5 countries. So this has been much smaller. And I sort of said in the tweet, I have a very strong suspicion that the number of countries I visit in 2021 will be 1. maybe two, because I can see us getting a bubble with New Zealand, but I just feel that it's just the way everything's going. It's extremely unlikely that I will have a combination of the need and the desire and the ability to actually fly to Dubai and then on to Europe or things like that. That is just the world that we are still living in, despite the fact it's a new year. Now, what else is on here? What was Google Maps telling you to do originally? Right, so Andrew's question. So Google Maps was telling us to drive on an unsealed road. Now, one of the things I've learned, and it bit me twice, actually. It bit me once before we left, and I figured it out, and I'm like, that's fine. And it bit me again after dropping the kids off at the airport in Cairns and before driving to Richmond, where I'd look at it in Google Maps and go, okay, that's reasonable. But I've been using Waze a lot because Waze tells you things like when there's a breakdown or when there's other things that you should look out for on the road. We'll just leave it at that. And I'm looking at Waze, and it's like, why is Waze 150 kilometers longer? So, yeah, Google Maps has no concept of routing around dirt roads. And I did actually end up going onto Google and searching for this because I'm like, you know how you can avoid tolls and you can avoid ferries and stuff like that? I'd really like to avoid dirt roads because it is a low, high-performance car with very low-profile tires. It's, I would not want to be stuck on a dirt road for any long period of time. So the solution to this has been I've just had to fire up Waze and take Google Maps with a grain of salt, which frankly is pretty shitty, particularly when Google owns Waze as well. Apple Maps, incidentally, also has the correct data. That sends us the right way. It's really just been Google Maps, which has been the outlier there. Now, incidentally as well, just in case people are wondering, in terms of the quality of the roads, it's been absolutely beautiful. So driving across here into the desert, I honestly think I've seen one pothole, and it wouldn't have been a bad one. I've seen one pothole. The roads are in the 130 zones. In fact, everywhere, there is no like dual carriageway, divided medium strip stuff. Everything is just one lane this way, one lane that way, very occasionally an overtaking lane because you don't need it. Because there's so few cars out here and everything's straight and flat, you can just overtake anyway. So the roads have just been beautiful. And, you know, some of the surfaces are a little bit different, some of them a bit quieter, some of them a bit louder. But it's just, it is perfect to drive on. There is a lot of the country where there is no cell signal, though. So I run Apple CarPlay. I can always see whether I've got 3G, 4G, 5G, any G. And a significant portion of the trip, there's no signal whatsoever. So if you did break down, you're going to be relying on the charity of strangers. You're going to have to wave someone down. But there's enough cars going past that I don't think you'd ever be waiting more than 15, 30 minutes and someone would come past. But I would hate to break down out here. I'd hate to have a flat tire because I've only got a can of goo. I don't have a full-size spare. The car doesn't come with them. A lot of modern cars are sacrificing that for the can of goo because you get more luggage space and all the rest of it. So fortunately, touch wood, that hasn't happened. And I haven't had to rely on the can of goo. In fact, I put an extra can of goo in there from the GTR just in case I needed more cans of goo. And if I do need the goo, then you can only do 80K an hour, which would have been really painful in a 130 zone. And you've pretty much got to chuck the tire away after that. And getting tires of those sizes would not be pretty if I had to do that out here either. And incidentally as well, like a lot of high-performance cars, the tires on the front are different to the tires on the rear. So even if you did have a spare tire, you'd have to find something like the old Space Saver spare, which could have worked front and rear. Other questions. Ace will swing by Sydney on your trip. All right. So, of course, this has thrown a spanner in the works. So for folks overseas, Australia's handled COVID exceptionally well, I think in part due to good luck, due to the geography of the place. We're an island in the middle of nowhere, and it's a lot easier to control people coming and going, in part due to I think the management has actually been good despite people getting very upset about particularly some of the state leaders. So we haven't had a lot of it, but there has been an outbreak in New South Wales, particularly in Sydney. Now, it sort of started to happen in northern beaches in Sydney. And we're looking at the numbers going, ah, crap, but this isn't good. We were planning to go to the Blue Mountains, which is actually part of Greater Sydney. That was going to be the last stop along the way. We booked a really nice place there. Now, unfortunately, because of the outbreak, a number of states, including my home state of Queensland, have said, if you have been to anywhere in Greater Sydney within the last 14 days, you cannot come back into the state without quarantining in a hotel at your expense for another 14 days, which would be absolute hell. So we made the call that we're going to have to scratch that, full refund, no problems, decided to stay a night in Tamworth. And then things have just progressively gone downhill. There's cases in Victoria now, but then Victoria and I think South Australia and Western Australia have blocked all of New South Wales. Now, the problem is if you block all of New South Wales, we literally can't drive back through. And at least up until an hour ago, Queensland hadn't announced blocking all of New South Wales, but I fully expect it will happen because Queensland has been pretty aggressive with border controls, although that was leading up to an election, so who knows. So the working theory at the moment is we're still going to go to Coober Pedy, we're going to go to Barossa Valley, the wine region, all this is in South Australia, going to go visit a mate of mine down on the coast, still in South Australia. We're going to spend an extra night with him, and then we're going to drive back to Adelaide, put the car on a transporter, which is much cheaper than what I thought it was, get on a plane, fly back to Brisbane, get a car back down to home, and that's it. So, yeah, answer to the question is, unfortunately, it looks like we're going to be missing probably the two big things I didn't want to miss was going to Thredbo and hiking up Kosciuszko, and also going to that Blue Mountain State. So, unfortunately, it looks like we have to scratch those, but we still get to do everything else. So I'm okay with that. I'm literally going to call the car transport place tomorrow and book that in, book some tickets, and it'll cut the holiday a little bit short. But honestly, like, so much of the holiday was about getting here to this place and doing what we've been doing here. So, yeah, I don't feel too bad about that. All right, looking at the other comments just here. What else is here? Would be cool if there was a 3 to 5 minute short video of Troy's cruise. I would have loved to have done like a time lapse. And I guess I could have, but I just didn't want more stuff to organize. But the time lapse would have been epic because we've just been to so many different places. If you need to drive at night, tailgate a road train and use it as a shield. Yeah, nah. It's not going to come to that, I'll tell you that much. All right. Darren's made a comment, three countries if you go to Tassie. So actually Tassie, Tasmania, our southern state, this little one that hangs off the bottom, that has been on the shortlist for quite some time since pre-COVID, just like this place was on the shortlist since pre-COVID. So that's somewhere that I'd really like to go to. And yeah, I think that places like that and maybe going somewhere like Broome on the northwest coast in Australia is stuff we're going to do this year because let's face it, we're just not going to be going overseas this year. Not unless it's over the sea to Tasmania. So look, that's it from here. I'm going to keep posting photos and stuff as I go along. At this stage, I suspect it'll be 6 days from now that I'm probably going to be sitting on the plane on the way home, all going to plan. So the next update will come from my office back home. And hopefully between now and then, I haven't hit a kangaroo or anything like that. So for everyone else in all your different parts of the world, I hope you've had an awesome New Year's Eve. It has been just the weirdest time for all of us in all our different ways. So hopefully 2021 is different. I don't know, honestly, if it's going to be a lot better, but it is going to be different. Let's just see what it brings. I do know that there's going to be a heap more data breaches. You heard it here first. That is definitely going to happen. And I'll keep talking about those as we get into the year. Thanks, folks. Have a happy new year. See ya.